This is a conversation with Krithika Varagher on her book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. Our conversation will look at Krithika's reporting, in particular with a focus on Indonesia, looking at how Saudi funding into religious schools, institutions, and civil society groups fundamentally changed the nature of Islam in Indonesia. We'll also talk quite a bit about how Saudi Arabia's statecraft is intimately connected to the Wahhabi Islam based within the country, how capitalism has shaped both Saudi Islam and Islam globally, as well as why the majority of Muslim countries have been so silent on campaigns such as the War on Terror, the abuse suffered by Kashmiris, Bosniaks, and Palestinians, and most recently, the horrific campaign of concentration camps in China against the Uyghur and Kazakhs of Xinjiang. It's a conversation that will look at Saudi Arabia, global Islam, capitalism, and the state in very interesting and insightful ways that I haven't heard discussed elsewhere. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast. We're on Apple, Spotify, and other platforms. And for great print interviews, you can go to our website at asiaarttours.com. We have a great interview out on Hui Muslims in China. All right, here's our conversation with Krithika Varagher. I hope you enjoy.
I'm Krithika Varagher. I'm an American journalist. I'm currently based in New York, and I spent the last 4 years as a foreign correspondent, mainly in Indonesia, but also reporting from across Southeast Asia and South Asia about religion, politics, fundamentalism, and extremism. My new book that came out in April this year is The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project, and it's about how Saudi Arabia's missionary campaign transformed the Muslim world, which I reported from Indonesia, Nigeria, Kosovo, Saudi Arabia, and Washington, D.C. Now I'm back in the U.S., and I'm reporting mainly on things like racial justice and policing, and I'm also a National Geographic scholar who was and hopefully will again be retracing the footsteps of Alfred Russel Wallace through the Malay Archipelago.
So for you going into this, even as someone who it sounds like is well educated and perhaps very reflective in your thinking, how did your beliefs or knowledge systems about Islam change through your process of reporting on your book, The Call?
I think my foundational framework for thinking about Islam, the Islamic world, was really informed by the so-called War on Terror, because I was 7 years old when 9/11 happened. And, you know, growing up in the shadow of that in America, it's hard not to, it's hard for those kinds of headlines not to leave an impression on you. At the same time, because I did have something of an international background myself or a diasporic identity, I got the sense that some of these frames were pretty naive. So it was a major interest of mine once I became a foreign correspondent to report on the Islamic world, which had been in, you know, kind of distorted, and the subject of scaremongering and all sorts of things for most of my childhood and my adult life. But the way I wanted to report on it was not from the Middle East region. I decided to go to Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim majority country, and increasingly Southeast Asia and South Asia are the demographic centers of the Islamic world. So that was always very interesting to me. Indonesia is very interesting because it's a highly religious democracy and it bucks a lot of the secularization hypotheses that are popular in IR and foreign policy circles, at least in the West, because as it has become more and more democratic, there's been more and more room for religion and religious actors in the public sphere. So one thing I will admit to is that it's really hard to shake off some of the tropes of secularization, even if you're a skeptic when you start reporting on those things. So one of the first major news cycles that I was a part of in Indonesia was about this, the blasphemy trial of a Christian governor in Jakarta, which was spearheaded by an Islamist group. And the most popular headline that was repeated across all the newspapers about that was this idea of tolerance on trial. And there are some catchphrases you have to use as a foreign correspondent wherever you're writing from. In Indonesia, one of them, of course, is that it's the world's largest Muslim majority country. But there were tropes that I almost unconsciously repeated in my early work, I think, about how the increased presence of religious actors by itself was a sign of something undemocratic or backsliding in democracy, which pretty soon after I got there and learned the dynamics of what was actually happening, seemed like a nonsensical frame to me. So I stopped using that. But that was a learning process. And, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing to learn what your biases are, but I'm glad I went through it and pushed through it. And then in the course of writing my book, which is about Saudi money, I was actually unpacking two different parallel discourses of Arabization. One was Indonesian and one was kind of American and Western. So in Indonesia, there is a Bahasa Indonesia word called Arabisasi, which is the notion that Saudi Arabia has somehow corrupted or fundamentally changed Indonesian Islam and is the root of almost every part of the conservative turn in Indonesian public life, which is kind of this newfound visibility of religion and piety after 1998. And then of course in America, we had the notion that Saudi Arabia was sort of a fountainhead of terrorism and extremism, not least because of 15 of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals. So when I started reporting on what Saudi money actually did in Indonesia, I was unpacking both of these discourses. And the biggest adjustment I had to make in when I was confronted with the facts is that Saudi Arabia, of course, did not single-handedly cause the conservative turn in Indonesia. So I definitely pushed myself to be as empiricist as possible and report as concretely on the specific institutions they built and the specific people who were in their orbit and the relationships that were central to the soft power project without ascribing them too much influence for every single expression of piety that took place in post-colonial Indonesia. So moderating the frame and making it less sensationalist than maybe would have made the best headlines was something I had to learn as I reported through this. And the second major realization that I had while I was reporting my book, which was kind of a sneaking suspicion in the beginning, but was reinforced as I went to more and more countries, so it became a repeated pattern in Nigeria and in Kosovo, was that Saudi proselytization had very much peaked in absolute terms. So in some sense, I was writing a history. That was one of the modes I was writing in. So a lot of the things and people I was writing about were either reminiscing about the peak of Saudi influence or were themselves very old kind of living legacies of Saudi influence. But across the board, I had to listen to what people were telling me, which is that in material terms, Saudi funding and Saudi influence had decreased after 9/11. So what I was writing about was very much after this kind of crest. So to account for both of those things was a big adjustment I made. And as I developed the themes of my book, and connected the dots across different countries, I became more comfortable with that kind of nuanced idea.
And for Saudi Arabia, obviously with the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in a particularly brutal fashion, it I imagine, had to be on the mind of any journalist who does serious reporting on the capital or statecraft of Saudi Arabia, that they have in the past inflicted violence on their critics or on individuals trying to shine a light on what is probably deliberately made opaque by the Saudi state or Saudi capital. And so we've already talked about not wanting to sensationalize, even if it means better headlines or ratings. What are the real sort of dangers of the type of reporting you're doing, if any, and for journalists students who I'm sure you've given talks or lectures, what do people need to be prepared for if they want to do the type of reporting that you did?
I mean, Jamal Khashoggi's murder, beyond being just an abomination and an outrage, it took place just a few weeks after I signed my book contract to write a book about Saudi Arabia. So it was definitely scary. And, you know, soon after details started to leak out, I was in constant contact with my editor because my original reporting plan involved going to Saudi Arabia kind of just as a tourist, just to get a lay of the land, since my book focused mainly on its influence in other countries. But we kind of scrapped that provisionally because there was a feeling that it was simply not safe for any foreigner to go there after something like that happened. I will say, as a year passed and I was getting closer to my book deadline, I started to feel like I couldn't just not go to Saudi Arabia if I was writing this book. It was kind of like it would have been like a donut shaped thing with a big hole in the middle. So I decided to go eventually in November of 2019 as a tourist. I think the influence of the Khashoggi affair made me a little bit reluctant to try and do more intense journalism inside the kingdom. Although since then I've had very receptive feedback from the King Faisal Center in Riyadh. So I'm hoping to go back in a more formal research capacity. But I will say I didn't, you know, the long tail and the long shadow cast by the murder meant that I was a little bit more wary of, you know, doing any journalism inside the kingdom. And I really didn't do any journalism inside the kingdom. It wasn't crucial to my book, frankly, which was more about the influence on countries in the fringe of the so-called Islamic world. But that was a very direct, I mean, it was just impossible to make an informed risk assessment. And I just ended up going as a tourist to visit the country. And I will say I had a good experience and I hope to return as a formal researcher. And then in terms of the research I did in the three other countries, I didn't really feel in danger at any point. I think in Kano, which is the biggest city in northern Nigeria, where I did a lot of my field work, there's a little bit of an ambient security risk, which I did a hostile environment training course to prepare for. But again, I don't think I was in any danger when I was there, and I felt pretty safe because of the contacts that I'd set up there. The only time I felt in danger in Indonesia was when I tried to visit a school that hoped to educate Papuan students in a suburb of Jakarta, and they really didn't want me to be there, and I was kind of forcibly escorted out, which only stands out to me because that's the only time something like that has ever happened to me in Indonesia. But I would say, other than that, I wouldn't want to exaggerate the risks of what I did too much. I felt pretty safe for most of the time I was reporting the book.
So to explore the book further, we'll need to touch upon a few terms. And you make a point in the book in explaining why the nuance and differentiation between these terms is very important, as well as how the callous indifference to these terms being reported improperly is perhaps a form of Orientalism in Western media. And those terms are Wahhabi Islam and Salafist Islam. I'm wondering if you could talk about these terms and why they're important in your book, as well as perhaps, if anything comes to mind, why there is this sort of orientalist or callous indifference to properly defining these terms in Western media, maybe mass media as opposed to more academic media, but why there's this callous indifference to properly defining these terms when they have such a deep impact on people's lives in the Islamic world.
Yeah, it's still a little bit of a mystery to me why it's so, why there's no consequences to getting this wrong. I think maybe the national security sphere rewards a certain degree of obfuscation, but the answers are out there. It's certainly not hard to understand the difference. I think the onus on anyone who talks about Islamic terrorism must know the difference. So I tried to be very precise about these things in my book. You know, I think Wahhabi in the post 9/11 era became kind of an epithet or a common derogatory term for a whole class of developments that people found troubling. And it became kind of to the level of cocktail party discourse, where you could kind of meet any educated person in any kind of world capital, and they read the world news, they might have an idea about Wahhabism or Saudi Wahhabi Islam. You know, I think it's on the colloquial level, I kind of understand that because that's how discourse works. Certain terms get filtered out from specialized to more colloquial discourse. But I think there's no excuse for the ongoing confusion of these terms in the national security world. So Wahhabism is the state religion of Saudi Arabia. It's named after an 18th century preacher named Muhammad Ibn Abdul Wahhab. So his name, it's an eponym. So he was a very austere preacher who had a very unique and stringent conception of Islam based on something called Tawheed, which is oneness, which he thought was the essence of monotheism. So in some ways, and as this was explained to mid-century Americans working in Aramco, it was kind of Unitarian Islam. So he was really against practices like worshiping at tombs, venerating saints, celebrating the prophet's birthday, singing songs, and all kinds of things like that. And he sought to exert his influence in various parts of the Arabian Peninsula, often violently, often destroying some of the most historic sites in the Arabian Peninsula, including tombs and shrines and things like that. Towards the end of that century, he formed a pact with the House of Saud, a royal family that was also seeking to establish a state under its own name on the peninsula. And the pact that they forged was that the Wahhabi doctrine and the charisma of the preacher would give religious legitimacy to this royal family, and in turn, the royal family would protect the preacher's sect and adopt his mission as their state's mission. So there are really, you know, that pact is in place up until today, and the Saudi royal family continues to be Wahhabi, and there's a powerful class of Wahhabi clerics inside Saudi Arabia. But the important thing about Wahhabism is that it is site-specific, so it has so much to do with obedience to the House of Saud and the Saudi royals that it only really makes sense within Saudi Arabia and also in Qatar, which is also a Wahhabi state technically. And if you ask someone in Saudi Arabia whether they're Wahhabi, chances are they would say, no, I'm just a Muslim. So it's kind of a useful descriptor of their state religion, but almost no one in the world would call themselves a Wahhabi, even if they read and have memorized Wahhab's Book of Tawheed. So when Saudi Arabia started to spread its state religion around the world in the 20th century, after the modern Saudi state came together in 1932, they had a Wahhabi mission in mind to spread Wahhabi Islam, but what they were spreading in practice usually turned out to be Salafism, which is a discrete historical movement with a lot of elective affinities in practice with Wahhabism. So in practice, Wahhabis and Salafis kind of believe a lot of the same things. But really quickly, Salafism arose in 19th century Egypt in reaction to Western imperialism and colonialism. And the idea was that the way for the Islamic world to move forward is by looking back to the Salaf, so the earliest 3 to 4 generations of Muslims, and trying to emulate their way of life. So Salafis are also very literalist, scripturalist, and they're into kind of very specific practices like wearing short pants above their ankles and having long untrimmed beards and things like that. So In practice, because Wahhabism is so site-specific to the House of Saud, what it's created when Saudi influence has been wielded abroad is these kinds of Salafi communities. And Salafism is very transnational. It always has been. And that's, you know, one of the most appealing things about it is that when you become a Salafi somewhere like Indonesia or Kosovo, you do join this global community of believers.
For Salafism, you make a point of noting that a lot of its origins come from anti-imperialist philosophy and direct actions against Western Empire, I believe particularly the British. Does Salafism still maintain a lot of anti-colonial or anti-imperialist threads and energy within it? And if so, how have states, I guess, both use Salafism, but also particularly for the monarchs of the Middle East, how has it also been sort of a Pandora's box in many ways in the Islamic world?
That's a good question. I think the majority of practicing Salafis in the world, which, you know, unlike Wahhabis, plenty of people are happy to identify as Salafis, have either forgotten or it's just irrelevant that there are these anti-colonial origins. You know, if you go back to the foundational Salafi authors who were mostly in Egypt, Muhammad Abdu and Rashid Rida, they're really talking about a near threat, the very near and visible anti-colonial struggle against the French and British and so on. But now that these are kind of mature states, there have been many generations of post-colonial leaders, that struggle is less relevant. There's obviously kind of anti-Western sentiment baked into Salafism, which is kind of how it's been transmogrified to the present day. And, you know, you also see that in like Iran, which is obviously not Salafi, but they have that concept of West toxification. So it's kind of been, it's morphed into a more generalized anti-Western discourse, which certainly has, you know, its own locomotive to keep going, given the war on terror and our forever wars and so on. But in terms of Salafism today, I think it's really like a transnational and kind of democratic movement, because Salafis all over the world can read the same books, which were once freely distributed or widely distributed as pamphlets and books in many different languages, and are now freely accessible on the internet, on blogs and internet and YouTube. So the key thing about Salafism that made it so appealing beyond the transnational identity is this promise of direct access to text, which is pretty anti-hierarchical, especially in places where there's like, you know, traditional Sufi power structures and things like that. So when people around the Muslim world become Salafi today, they often will, you know, adhere to a local charismatic preacher and then join this global community of believers. And for that reason, Salafism has been hard for individual states to really utilize or instrumentalize.
For Wahhabi Islam, just to drill into one point, where does the faith begin and the state end, or vice versa, in understanding this particular form of Islam?
So the Wahhabi ulama, or the clerics, are the only real body with power in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia beyond the Saudi royal family. So there's always been this push-pull relationship with them, which waxes and wanes over time. Right now, the Saudi royal family under Crown Prince MBS has tried to diminish their influence inside the peninsula, because a lot of the things that he wants to do under Vision 2030 would be kind of rejected by more dogmatic Wahhabi clerics. If there were no Saudi Arabia, I don't think there would be any organized Wahhabi base in the world. It's really defined in relation to the Saudi royal family. So I don't think Wahhabism would exist without Saudi Arabia.
But could you just very briefly define Saudi Dawah and the scope and scale? We didn't touch upon that.
Dawah is an Arabic word that means the call or invitation to Islam, and it gives the title of my book, The Call. And it can mean anything from the personal duty of a Muslim to invite people to Islam by acting in an exemplary way to kind of more organized missionary activities. So in my book, Saudi Dawah refers to the mesh of missionary activities that have taken place under the modern Saudi state and especially ramped up starting in the 1960s onward. And there's not one single source of Saudi Dawah. There are many different bodies involved, including a dedicated government ministry called the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, Dawah and Guidance, multinational charities like the Muslim World League and the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, wide variety of charities started by businessmen and lesser royals, and a network of at least two dozen religious attachés in countries around the world who report back to the Saudi Dawah Ministry and oversee Dawah activities in countries such as Indonesia and Nigeria. So an image that I use in my book that I think is helpful is that of an octopus. There's like a brain in the middle. They kind of have a similar thrust, but there's many different ways that Dawah is pursued and they're not always in concert with each other. And I just try to stress that because it's not like this single-minded, nefarious plot to spread a very specific idea, but a kind of loose mesh of different bodies and actors that have changed a lot throughout the years.
So in terms of statecraft, you have two quotes that I'm going to read back-to-back here, and then I'm going to ask a question based on them. So from your book, The Call, you write, "Saudi Arabia, of course, opposed communism and leftism on its own terms and was not merely a pawn of the U.S. Those popular ideologies would deeply threaten the power of the monarchy if they ever caught on with the Saudi public." Later you say, you're quoting former CIA station chief Bruce Rydell. "Iran is a useful cover," said Bruce Rydell. "Saudis don't like to be called leader of the counter-revolution in the Arab world, but that's what they are." For statecraft, and if Wahhabism comes into play here, please bring that up as well. But just for statecraft as the focal point, how has Saudi Arabia been what Mr. Rydell says, the sort of leaders of counter-revolution in the Arab world? And how was Islam, if at all, and particularly Saudi-style Wahhabi Islam, used for these counter-revolutionary ends?
I want to answer that by briefly referencing the Bandung Conference, which took place in 1955 in Indonesia, also known as the Afro-Asian Conference. And it was this kind of amazing assemblage of post-colonial nations and all the, you know, all the superstars were there, Nehru, Nasser, Sukarno, and so on. And Saudi Prince Faisal was also there. And it was this kind of unique assemblage of post-colonial, but also, states from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia in general, kind of figuring out what the future would look like. And it's interesting that the Saudi king was basically a nobody there. The real leaders and the people whose vision seemed the most promising for the future were these kinds of Western-educated, progressive, liberal, pluralist-minded leaders like Nehru and Sukarno. And the currents that seemed most promising in the Muslim world in those years were either these kinds of post-colonial nation-building projects, like in Indonesia, or things like Arab socialism in Egypt. And that was where the momentum seemed to be in mid-century. Of course, as we know, a lot of these promising nation building ideas either collapsed or completely changed. And instead, the Saudi vision of personal piety instead of kind of progressive nation building was much more successful. And this was not by accident. It was like a big, massive global effort. And it's not only because Saudi Arabia had such an ambitious campaign and not only because it became very rich with oil, especially after 1973, which is when the Arab-Israeli war happened, but it's also because they found a great partner in the United States. And both of these countries had anti-communist and anti-socialist goals of their own. And together, their various efforts kind of overturned many of the energies that were encapsulated in the Bandung Conference. The revolutionary energies that were deeply threatening to Saudi Arabia were not just Iran, which is the obvious one, because that was like a Shia popular revolt against a monarchy, which was obviously disturbing to Saudi Arabia, but also kind of Arab socialism in North Africa, because that just had a, you know, had a locus of power outside centralized rulers. So both of those kinds of populist energies were deeply threatening to Saudi Arabia, which was a theocratic monarchy and was trying to assert its place on the global stage as the birthplace of Islam. So that's why Saudi Arabia put so much energy into these counter-revolutionary efforts to kind of channel these progressive nation-building sentiments into personal piety and kind of belief and identity in this global ummah or community of believers whose locus was in Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, historically, and this is not in doubt, the birthplace of Islam, and it's home to the two holiest mosques in Islam. So this drive from like these communal progressive nation building projects into personalized, individualized piety was a big goal of Saudi Arabia. And you can see why that is basically counter-revolutionary in its thrust. So the US and Saudi Arabia worked together all across Africa in something known as the Safari Club and in a lot of other countries to foil various revolutionary groups. And it was a time at which Henry Kissinger once wrote in his memoirs that wherever he wanted to, you know, deal with a pesky communist group, he would find a helpful Saudi fingerprint there. And what the only thing I want to flag after this is that although America made a big 180 on the idea of Islamic terrorism in this century, back then in the 70s and 80s, this fundamentalist version of Islam promoted by Saudi Arabia and in so many countries was seen as an asset, and American leaders in internal discussions and, you know, high-level security dialogues really promoted it as a useful tool against communism. So the change in American policy towards this kind of fundamentalist version of Islam is severe whiplash that I think we tend to forget.
Not to overstay my welcome in a cliche, but when it comes to the Pandora's box of counter-revolutionary Islam, so Saudi Dawah being used to fund schools that would promote sort of personal piety over global shared prosperity or more communal or communistic politics, like journalists like Vincent Bevins have documented, were very prevalent within the Islam of Sukarno's Indonesia. What has the battle looked like, very broad strokes, between the state or Islamic states trying to define through either the resources of capital or through state violence against what it considers heretics, and Islamists or Muslims who seek to define an Islam that exists outside of what the state says is appropriate or is an acceptable mode of Islam within these countries. So within, let's say, a Saudi Arabia, how does it police Islam itself? And then how does it try to export this logic of carcerality and policing of Islam globally through things like Saudi Dawah?
Yeah, I mean, so the central tenet of Wahhabism is takfir, which is this idea of excommunicating wrong Muslims, so Muslims who are outside of the orthodoxy of Wahhabism. And at various points in Saudi Wahhabi history, that's either meant like violently killing takfiris or just maybe putting them in jail or codifying certain behaviors into law. But basically, the takfiri attitude is central to Wahhabism. So inside the kingdom, it's policed by a variety of actors. And again, this varies in severity throughout the years, but after 1979, for example, where the Grand Mosque of Mecca was occupied by Saudi, kind of like a guerrilla group called Juhayman's Revolt, the Committee on Vice and Virtue really cracked down on what was orthodoxy inside the kingdom, and the Wahhabi clerics were given much more leeway over the education ministry and the schools and the mosques and everything like that. Right now, it's on the waning part of that cycle because Vision 2030, which is the prince's economic modernization plan, is trying to downplay that kind of piety and fundamentalism. So it necessarily involves pushing back against more kind of extreme wishes of the Wahhabi ulama. But basically, because takfir, this kind of takfir concept is so central to Wahhabism, policing what it means to be a good Muslim is very central to the Saudi state. And then outside Saudi Arabia, I think this movement by many countries around the world to define their own national versions of Islam, whether it's Turkish Islam, Emirati Islam, Indonesian Islam, is a little bit more of a recent development than the kind of mid-century origins of the project I'm talking about. So in the mid-century, it really was more of a global ummah that had the most currency. So being a Muslim means being part of the world of Islam. And there were all these transnational organizations created around that time, headquartered in Saudi Arabia, like the World Assembly of Muslim Youth and the Muslim World League. And it was this kind of feeling of transnational Muslim identity. But as countries became more and more religious on their own terms and slowly abandoned their kind of secular nation building projects, it became more important for countries within the so-called Muslim world to define their own regional Islams. So you can think of this as kind of a Westphalianization of the Islamic world, where there's now like more of a balance of powers, where many different countries around the world are interested in defining their own kinds of Islam, including, you know, somewhere like Indonesia. So it's not just a Gulf thing. To me, that's more of a recent development.
Mona Atiyah's work on the practices of zakat sort of being eroded by a state that increasingly is paranoid about any sources of capital, even charitable giving in the form of zakat, sort of an Islamic almsgiving practice, has led to the development instead of, and you've alluded to this, sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps Islam. Whereas charities before in Egypt might have just given directly to the poor, now there is much more a language of neoliberal self-actualization, of training people to do coding, or of training people to work in service industry jobs. Whereas before, zakat would have acted as just sort of direct giving to the poor. And this rose to prominence twice, first through Mubarak, who wanted to centralize control, and now under Sisi, with a brief interlude from the Muslim Brotherhood that ended in tragedy for Egypt. I'm wondering, when we look at sort of the life world of Islam, either in Saudi Arabia or some of the places you studied, on a more micro level of anthropology, did people talk about some of these changes of an increase in selfishness, an increase in sort of self-reliance, an increase in having to rely on oneself, sort of the language of neoliberal bare life creeping into an Islam that historically has been very generous, been very concerned about the well-being of the poor? How did you see some of the this Wahhabi language, or as you sort of said, just personal piety, creep into Islamic spaces that perhaps before had been much more communal? Could you talk about that on a more micro level in your field work?
Just briefly, within Saudi Arabia, it's basically like a rentier state. So if you are a Saudi citizen and not one of the millions of migrant workers there, you get a lot from the government. So it's kind of funny to think about, because it's like, I mean, it's almost, they get a lot of welfare. And that's been one of the biggest adjustments they've had to make in the last few years. is to slightly contract the welfare state, which is no longer sustainable under decreased oil revenues of the last few years. But in terms of personal piety, I mean, yeah, if we think that one of the major features of neoliberalism and late capitalism is this hyper individualization, then, you know, somewhere like Indonesia, where there are so many different ways to express your piety, it becomes like a form of self-expression, I think is relevant. Like, you can join a mosque, or you can post to social media, or you can, you know, give to this and this charity, and so on. So, you know, ways of being pious are very much tied to individual identity as a way to express yourself. And even among young people, like millennials, there's this hijra movement to be far more pious in many cases than their parents' generation. So it's really like Islamic identity as a form of self-expression, which I think is really interesting. And again, I'm describing this in as neutral way as I can, because I don't, you know, I think the Western media tendency is to describe this as a worrisome development. And to me, it's not necessarily that. And, you know, Nigeria too is hyper-capitalist state. It's also an oil-producing country. There has been huge gaps in welfare, especially in the northern part of the country, which has much lower developmental progress than the southern part, and is where I did most of my field work. So there, a lot of Islamic charity organizations, and especially the Salafi movements that popped up in the last 4 to 5 decades, take the place of you know, state services in a lot of ways, including the schooling and things like that. So I definitely think there's a linkage there.
Were there any stories from the gathering of stories for your fieldwork of people saying that the type of Islam, this more communal type that you had mentioned in the era of Nehru or Sukarno, that it has really changed to a more sort of an Islam more matching the capitalism of our times? And I doubt they would have used that sort of specific language, but were there any similar themes of that sort of feedback in your fieldwork?
I was going to say, well, you beat me too. I don't think they would have used those terms or seen themselves necessarily as subjects of capitalism. But I think a good example of, that speaks to what you're talking about is in Kosovo, where the trends I write about took place in a really condensed period of time, basically 1998 up until now, so like 2 decades. And then under communist Yugoslavia, religious life was greatly suppressed. So this kind of efflorescence took place in an accelerated way. But it's also that during communist period and then during the brutal wars of independence that Kosovo went through, a lot of their houses of worship were destroyed, and a lot of the traditional Islamic structures were also destroyed over those many, many decades. So the only, you know, the major ways to be Islamic in Kosovo today, which is a 99% Muslim country, at least on paper, is super individualistic. It's by following these kind of entrepreneurial preachers who are good at going on TV, or good at are handy with YouTube and media and things like that, and being part of this kind of greater Albanophone Muslim world and the transnational Salafi world, because the traditional organizations are so depleted, they are almost non-existent. So I think that's kind of a process of hyper-individualization in the Islamic sphere you can see in Kosovo and in quite a few other kind of Balkan countries. But that, I think Kosovo is the most extreme example just because of the particular circumstances of that state. And that was really obvious to me there.
And to conclude this sort of line of questioning, and I'm sorry, it's a pet interest of mine, how do we survive the era of ripped Jeff Bezos and figure out a way forward? Dr. Joshua Hendrick of, I believe it's Loyola University, wrote a great book that pops up occasionally whenever I think journalists in bad faith want to do an Orientalist profile on Turkey rather than actually look into the really amazing text he wrote, which is called Gulen, The Ambiguous Politics of Market Islam in Turkey and the World. You said something in our conversation just now, and I think I've said it a few times, where you said, look, I'm not necessarily trying to asperse judgment, cast judgment on if more conservative or more neoliberal or any of these forms of Islam. You know, I don't think good or bad are a useful heuristic in talking about them. And and please correct me if I'm not framing your language correctly there. But if I am framing your language correctly, Dr. Hendrick builds off that to essentially say, for the type of Islam he studied, the Gulenist movement in Turkey, that for a lot of people who joined this particular brand, I think he might call it, of Islam, because it was so heavily tied into sort of corporate branding and almost like a mid-level marketing in a lot of ways, that they did it because simply it offered them better opportunities in life. That Gulenist schools were very well connected to teachers who could provide excellent STEM education. They had very strong contacts with leading universities in Turkey. They had the ability to get you jobs, whereas a worker who did not have access to these networking opportunities within the Gulenist movement might have a much harder go of it in finding positions for themselves, either in terms of their education or in terms of employment. And in reading your work on Saudi Dawah, though you're not as explicitly focused on sort of Islam within capitalism, that does seem to come up as well, where you have all these spaces where maybe there's not a lot of good job opportunities, maybe people are politically at odds with the state, maybe that there has not been huge amounts of resources for people who are practicing Muslims, and then all of a sudden something like Saudi Dawah comes in with huge amounts of money, with linkages back to Saudi Arabia, where you can get a very high quality university education, where you can study Arabic, where you can perhaps be linked up to employment opportunities within this network. And I'm wondering, through, again, your field work on perhaps more of a micro level, when you interviewed people, how did they talk about, it doesn't need to be in these explicit terms, but how did they perhaps talk about simply the networking opportunities that Saudi Dawah offered them, and how you came to see that or parse that as one of the main driving factors in why people might choose to become more interested in this particular school of Islam?
The material components of Saudi Dawah are clearly a big draw. And actually, some people did talk about it specifically in those terms. One of my favorite characters, or people I got to meet, but he's really a character, through the course of my reporting in Indonesia, is this guy, Muhammad Siddiq, who's a very erudite, cosmopolitan, Achenese scholar, who described getting swept up as a young man in the brand new nation of Indonesia. He was less enthused about the kind of secular nation building project, and he was more into the kind of sidelined Islamic movement under the exiled Prime Minister Mohamed Netsir. But anyway, he is a young guy from Aceh, which is the westernmost province of Sumatra, and it's a pretty conservative place. And he describes how once he got connected into this transnational network that was just being created at that time because of his mentor relationship with Netsir, he got swept up in this kind of exciting mid-century world of transnational youth ummah identity, where he'd go to these conferences in Riyadh and Jeddah and travel to Europe and all over the world, meeting young Muslims from all around the world who are trying to figure out their place in their respective new countries. You know, he is by no means, like, it's hard to put someone like him in a box. He worked at the UN for a while. He lived in New York, but he also came back to Indonesia and leads the kind of premier Saudi funding recipient organization called DDII. And I think his journey and the way he talked about those opportunities as a young kid, not from a particularly wealthy family, who got the chance to see so much of the world because of this Saudi orbit that was being created, is part of the draw for sure. And I talk a lot in my book about one university called the Islamic University of Medina, which was explicitly built in the 1960s as a university to propagate the Saudi Dawah. And it was very international. Almost all of its students were international. Its leadership was international. One of its first presidents was Nigerian. A Pakistani scholar came up with the idea for it, and so on. And this university has been super influential in all three countries that I write about, Kosovo, Nigeria, and Indonesia. And the big draw of attending IUM was the chance to rub shoulders with scholars from all around the Islamic world. So these were really, and of course, going there is also on a full scholarship, full tuition, plus a stipend. So these are really major propositions to, I think, any kind of student. And especially when you look at the context of the particular states I'm writing about, especially somewhere like Kosovo, which is a war-torn country being reconstructed very piecemeal by UN body and, you know, US forces and things like that, the chance to attend this international university for free is very, very attractive. And, you know, same goes for a poor student from Nigeria or Indonesia. It just is the kind of the passport to this new kind of life. And also in, and certainly in most of Asia and many parts of Africa, learning Arabic really well in kind of like a Gulf inflected dialect is really prestigious and can open a lot of doors for you. So there are a lot of material incentives to partake in this project, which is not to say it's universally appealing. A huge number of students anecdotally drop out of IUM because they find the theology so abrasive and extreme that they can't really stomach it. A lot of people in Kosovo and Indonesia, whom I know and who I write about in my book, get swept up in the Saudi Dawah project because of these material incentives, and then come to violently reject it because, you know, they just can't compartmentalize it that much. So I think the material incentives are there, and they're a big part of the popularity of this project, but they're also not like, they're also not sweeping everything else about it under the rug.
So one of the more fascinating sections for me, and the complexity, when we all get reduced to Daryl Morey Moneyball and sort of Amazon tracking metrics, you know, that's when I know it's my time to just sail off to a desert island. I like a lot of these complexities and contradictions. I think they make us human. And one of the more interesting sort of, I don't know if it's even a contradiction, but right now is, like throughout much of history, a time of great violence against Muslims in India, in Kashmir, in Palestine, for Uyghurs, for the Rohingya, for Bosniaks, and obviously for the United States and anywhere that doughy white men are in power in Western nations. And I'm thinking of multiple world leaders who meet that description. That culpability against ethno-fascists like a Xi Jinping, like a Modi, like a Trump, is being met with a great deal of silence from quote-unquote the Muslim world, Muslim state leaders, and so on. There's been very little public condemnation about what's occurring in Xinjiang. I believe it was the UAE just normalized relations with Israel despite no real progress, and in fact an increase in state-led violence and destruction against Palestinians. I'm wondering, for much of your fieldwork is quite recent, and a great deal obviously took place during the war on terror, quote unquote, you know, this never-ending conflict. What did you make of that contradiction, and what did the practicing Muslims, particularly those who had been influenced by Saudi Dawah, how did they explain this contradiction to you? How did they explain their silence or the state's silence on these sort of global acts of violence against Muslims?
Well, the weird question is a great one. And a lot of people are surprised to learn that Saudi Arabia basically does not condemn the Uyghur ethnic cleansing at all. And even parrots the rhetoric of the CCP that it is a domestic counter-extremism problem. So the reason for that, of course, is high-level Saudi-China elite cooperation, wherein China financed the railroad between Mecca and Medina and has a lot of other infrastructural inputs into the modern Saudi state. So because the elites are okay with it, they're not going to talk about this issue at all. And then in Indonesia, my friend Don over at the Wall Street Journal has written a very illuminating story on how China has literally bought the silence of the world's largest Muslim majority country by flying out members of its major civil society organizations, as well as, you know, Instagram and travel influencers to go on kind of state sanctioned trips to Xinjiang and say everything's fine with this, you don't have a problem with it. So it was a very, very concerted effort on China's part to buy silence of Indonesia and so many other countries on this issue, and they've been quite successful so far. In terms of how do people square their Ummah identity with staying silent on these issues, it's a good question. I think all of us are able to live with certain, you know, contradictions because we live in a society. And I think they tend to channel their feelings of Ummah solidarity into kind of sanctioned buckets, like solidarity with Rohingya Muslims, which is universally popular in Indonesia, solidarity with Palestine, which is also universally popular in most Muslim communities around the world. And, you know, I think channeling their feelings into something like that is how you can be okay with the other stuff.
You mentioned specifically in your book that the ASEAN region of Indonesia, which is among the most conservative, but also among the most resistant to Saudi dawah, has been among the few places in the world that's really defied states and accepted Rohingya refugees. And we talked about sort of the origins of Salafism as being anti-colonial and anti-imperialist, anti-empire. Do you envision in this era of sort of global hypocrisy, what, along with an increase in violence against Muslims from states and increasingly with entities like Blackwater, nebulous private entities, do you see new forms or articulations of Islam emerging to address the global persecution of Muslims?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer to the very last thing you asked. Certainly as food for thought for future inquiries. But in terms of Aceh specifically, I think it's a really good example. For people who don't know, I mentioned it a little bit early in our conversation, it's the westernmost province of Indonesia, historically has been home to a separatist movement and has a very proud local regional identity and is pretty conservative. It's the only province in Indonesia that is allowed to have regional and provincial Sharia jurisdiction. So like they actually have Sharia courts and punishments and things like that. So it's like the only place in Indonesia where people can get publicly flogged for crimes, for example. And it was also one of the places in the world worst affected by the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004. So in the course of my research in Indonesia, Aceh was one of my major targets because I was like, this is a super conservative part of Indonesia, big window of opportunity for charity. I know there's a Saudi charity campaign there. I'm sure Saudi dawah has been super influential in Aceh. And I went there and I was totally wrong. In fact, they had mounted one of the strongest resistance to Saudi dawah that I've seen in my field work, where their traditionalist clerics and ulama have even come to blows with Salafi and Saudi educated preachers and pushed them out of big theaters like the Grand Mosque in Banda Aceh. And it's part of their regional identity, where a lot of people there would say it's fine if they want to donate to help us build orphanages or schools or whatever after the tsunami, we'll take their money, but we're not going to take their ideas. And that kind of clear-headed articulation of one way to approach Sadidawa was pretty unique to Aceh in my eyes, but it might become more of a pattern in other places in the world going forward, as the Saudi ideological project becomes less and less coherent as that decade progresses. But that example to me was also an important lesson in being open to new information and accounting for new information that you learn on the ground and not going into things with frames. Because if I hadn't gone there, my assumptions would have probably held. I would have Googled and saw that there's a Saudi charity office in Banda Aceh and kind of assumed the rest of it. So I was wrong, and I was happy to be corrected on that front.
The last question, I just finished the biography of Ashada Shakur, the autobiography, who I just read also was one of the main reasons Trump dissolved sort of the thawing of relations with Cuba, is that they would refuse to return Ashada Shakur. He mentioned her by name as a cop killer, and fascists have long memories and supremacists have long memories. For a man that stupid and venal to still hold a grudge against this woman, I think speaks a lot about his supremacist political project. But Islam historically for Black freedom struggles has been a major source of inspiration and strength. Obviously, Malcolm X would be the figure that came to mind for most American listeners. You mentioned Hearts and Minds, and last night reading Asada's words, she mentions that sort of specifically. She mentions Hearts and Minds as a big component of sort of the Black freedom struggles of the 60s and 70s. And without getting into the very complex topic of jihad, which at this point is you need to do a separate podcast on it entirely to unpack all the Orientalism and bad faith reporting on the subject of jihad. But in this moment of global uprising and protest, do you see a way that we can counter the counter-revolutionary aspects of Saudi Dawah? Did you, when you pick up, let's say, a newspaper report on Black Lives Matter or a protest like we're seeing now in Indonesia or in Thailand or in Kashmir, do you see sort of any of the techniques that Saudi Dawah used as ones that people protesting against state violence can perhaps put in their toolkit? And Hearts and Minds, which you mentioned specifically in your book, comes to mind here. But I just wanted to ask this sort of last, more speculative question, because I don't like Trump, and I suppose I'm more on the side of Asada.
I think the key framework to think through this is that Islam is the second largest religion in the world with 1.8 billion adherents, and there's just so many different streams in it that it's just a big tent, right? So there have always been, from the beginning of Islam, which was highly concerned with socioeconomic justice to an unusual degree, up until the present, there have always been these kinds of revolutionary and liberation applications of Islam. And even in Indonesia, around the mid-century, there was a big and influential nexus with kind of Islam as a liberation theology. And there were a lot of influential thinkers before Saudi Dawah kind of took hold there. But I would basically say, like, if someone, like the people I write about in my book, are seriously still part of the Saudi Dawah project or seriously part of these kind of Salafi networks, they're not going to be protesting for socioeconomic justice. I'm just painting in broad strokes here, but Salafism is basically apolitical and almost anti-political in spirit, which isn't to say that there aren't Salafi politicians or whatever, but a big part of this Dawah project has been to turn those revolutionary energies in individuals within this orbit into kind of self-policing and policing of others, just in terms of like narrow sorts of piety, which is one reason why one of the phenomena that I concentrate on so much in my book is intolerance of other Muslims and religious minorities that spins out as a result of this project. So basically, I would say that like there have always been, and there will continue to be, progressive Muslim leaders and movements and followers. But I basically think it is a, there's probably very little overlap with people who are committed to the kind of world that I describe in my book.
Krithika, this was a pleasure. I hope it didn't feel too much like your thesis defense. I really have come to dislike the sort of more jokey, casual nature that a lot of leftist or progressive politics have structured themselves for likes and clicks, and really enjoy these more, I hope, substantive conversations with people who've put in a lot of work. So I hope you'll excuse me for not making a bunch of silly jokes about Donald Trump or whatever people do on those sorts of podcasts. I really enjoyed our chat today, and for people who also enjoyed what I took to be a very rich and stimulating conversation, where can people find your work and follow you if they're interested in learning more?
Well, first of all, and thank you for the conversation anyway. I would have been really impressed if you found a lot of jokes to make about Saudi Dawah, because I don't even think I managed to do that in a couple hundred pages. But you know, you can find my work on, recently I've been writing for the New York Review of Books and The Intercept. Most of my work is on my website, which is just myname.com, and on my Twitter, which is @myname, Krithika Varakur. And my book is available anywhere that books are sold. I recommend bookshop.org if you're in America. They are a great website that supports independent bookstores. And if you're in any other country, Book Depository is a great website that has free shipping almost anywhere in the world.
Thank you.